From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. With Congress still in recess, debate over health care reform has made its way to our television sets via the first spate of ads. Many of those ads are from anti-health reform groups that rely on a device popular with the town hall protesters we've seen so much of on cable news these past few weeks, namely, scared the bejesus out of the elderly. Some ads warned seniors, for example, that an overhaul of the healthcare system would result in them losing access to services and even to their own physicians.
The government, not doctors, will decide if older patients are worth the cost.
Others go as far as to suggest that proposals currently before Congress will cut healthcare for seniors while using taxpayer dollars to pay for abortions.
They won't pay for my surgery, but we're forced to pay for abortions.
They're frightening claims for sure, but are they factually correct? Brooks Jackson is the director of factcheck.org. He says that many of these ads are indeed riddled with misinformation, and he joins us once again. Hey, Brooks, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
So what's the most egregious misstatement of fact, misinformation, propaganda, or lie that you've run across?
Well, I don't have a mendacity meter that would give me a scientifically accurate answer to that, but we've sure seen a lot of howlers out there, and you mentioned a couple. The claim, for example, that the House leadership bill would contain something called death panels and somehow require mandatory counseling, pushing people toward doctor-assisted suicide. Just utter bunk, of course.
All right, so what other scare tactics are being employed?
Well, there's an ad out from the 60 Plus Association saying that there would be long lines, you might lose your physician, that elderly are going to see benefit cuts in Medicare as a result of what's being proposed. Now, this is really ironic because when John McCain proposed saving some money in Medicare to pay for his health care proposal, the Obama folks attacked him in a couple of ads that we called false, saying that this would necessarily result in big cuts in Medicare benefits.
Now, there's another side to this argument, generally speaking, the side that is in support of, if not this particular House bill, the Obama initiative in general. How honest, straightforward, factually correct have the pro-health care reform ads been?
Well, the advertising has been largely fact-free, actually. The proponents say we must end things like insurance policies that don't cover pre-existing conditions. And it's phrased in terms of we should fix the system, we must do this, we must accomplish that. So they haven't really given us much to check of a factual nature, and we consequently haven't found a lot to object to in the ads run by the proponents.
Now, there's obviously an echo chamber out there. There's right-wing talking heads. There's the town hall meeting disruptions, which are heavily covered on 24-hour cable news. But these ads do influence people. Back in the Clinton era, a series of ads featuring a couple called Harry and Louise were largely credited with torpedoing the Clinton plan. Here's what they sounded like back then.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
Yeah, they choose.
We lose.
But now Harry and Louise are back, only this time they are not representing the opponents of healthcare reform, they are representing the proponents. And this is what they sound like 16 years later.
A little more cooperation, a little less politics, and we can get the job done this time.
Well, they've certainly changed sides, and I think this is indicative of something that's really gone largely unnoticed here. The special interest planets have shifted in their orbits since 1993, when the health insurance industry was against what the Clintons were proposing, when the pharmaceutical industry was against it. The American Medical Association wasn't very keen on it either. Now the American Medical Association, the very group that coined the term socialized medicine back when Harry Truman was proposing a national health care system, has actually endorsed the House legislation. They're certainly favoring and have been advertising in favor of an overhaul of the health care system of some sort. The pharmaceutical industry is financing ads favoring an overhaul of the system. Even the insurance industry itself the lobby representing the big guys, the Aetnas, the Blue Cross, Blue Shield guys, they have formally endorsed market reforms, things like ending non-coverage of pre-existing conditions and requiring insurance plans to take all comers. They also want, and this is interesting, they favor a personal mandate requiring individuals to be covered, to obtain coverage somehow. The big groups, the moneyed lobbies, are really in different positions now, and the advertising that we've seen attacking the overhaul of the healthcare system generally are coming from ideological groups and groups that basically are responsible only to their fundraisers, and there's a financial incentive, I think, for them to be as inflammatory as possible because it keeps the donations coming.
Well, Brooks, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Brooks Jackson is the director of FactCheck.org, a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. For historical precedent on healthcare reform, what first springs to mind, of course, is the Clinton administration fiasco in 1993 and 94. But using the Clintons' experience as an object lesson doesn't really tell the whole story. Attempts at a national healthcare program are almost a century old, says Princeton professor Paul Starr, author of the book The Social Transformation of American Medicine. And for as long as the idea has been popular among incoming administrations, it has been vilified and successfully derailed by critics. Starr knows this firsthand, because in addition to being an author and a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton, he was drafted by the Clinton White House to help avoid the mistakes of the past. He joins us now. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, Bob.
I want to start with where Brooks Jackson left off, and that is the Truman administration and a very successful effort by the American Medical Association to demonize any federal involvement as socialism. Can you take us back?
The issue of health insurance had first been raised before the First World War and was then defeated, partly because it was actually associated at that point with Germany. And when war broke out with Germany, it helped to sink that proposal. Then in the late 40s, which is, of course, when the Cold War was beginning, the opponents associated national health insurance, as it had come to be called, with Soviet-style socialism.
What exactly did the AMA and its PR people do to create the notion that a national health care plan was somehow Bolshevism?
They suggested that Lenin had supposedly said that healthcare was the first step toward instituting communism. There was a mythical quote that no one has been ever able to discover to that effect. And they argued that it was, you know, like a gateway drug, the beginning of a slippery slope toward government control of everything. In that period, given the Cold War, that argument was a powerful one.
Maybe the Lenin quote is somewhere in the House bill next to the death panels provision.
Page 764.
Now, before Truman, there was Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who himself had battles with the AMA. What was the nature of those?
Roosevelt never took on the AMA directly. The Committee for Economic Security, which recommended the old age insurance system that we know of as Social Security, they also recommended health insurance. But when Roosevelt had to decide what was he going to submit to Congress in 1935, he held back the health insurance provisions. He was afraid of the AMA's opposition and so decided to leave it to a later day. But during the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt and the American people had a lot of other things to worry about. And so he never got back to health insurance. And it was only Harry Truman who then was the first president to make national health insurance a cause.
It would have fit very snugly within the New Deal, but you're suggesting that FDR simply knew that he would not have the AMA on board and he needed them for other initiatives.
Well, he needed to pass Social Security, which was not an easy thing to do in 1935. And by the way, the opponents of Social Security also said it was socialism.
So if we can assume for just a moment that the president is right and the Clintons were right and Harry Truman was right and Teddy Roosevelt was right that the government should be intervening in the healthcare system, to keep down costs and create something close to universal coverage. What is it that the AMA in the 40s and 50s and the health insurance lobby in the 90s and the current ideological opponents in 2009 have been able to consistently do to obliterate the common sense of healthcare reform?
They've been able to raise fears among the haves that they will lose from reform. And America has a system that does provide protection to a lot of people. And yet, we all know that healthcare costs are rising. They're staggeringly high. And I think, as a result, even the haves are nervous about losing what they've got. And so, consequently, I think they can be mobilized against reform. The single biggest surprise this year is that the major healthcare interest groups have not been a factor in the mobilization against reform. It wasn't the AMA. It hasn't been the pharmaceutical industry. It hasn't been the hospitals. By and large, they've negotiated in many cases a pretty good deal for themselves. So it is an ideological and political opposition this time, almost purely. And here I think history is really exercising a very powerful effect, because the last time we fought this out, back in 1993-94, Republicans won. And so I think they are trying to reenact history. They are trying to do to Obama what they did to Clinton, not just to defeat healthcare reform, but to neutralize his entire agenda.
Well, Paul, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Coming up, a message to cable news some advertisers hate, hate speech. This is On the Media from NPR.
Jesse Thorne here, host and producer of The Sound of Young America. Our show's been such a successful podcast that some people don't know that it's also a nationally syndicated public radio program. With that in mind, I make sure to approach my interviews with the dispassionate objectivity that's expected of all good public radio journalism. Like when I spoke with the writers of The Late Show with David Letterman. I've been thinking a lot lately, probably too much, about a bit called How Many Spider-Mans Fit in a Jamba Juice.
Right. We really don't have time to deal with what that reflects in you, that you've been thinking about that a lot.
Check out The Sound of Young America and a whole bunch of other podcasts at MaximumFun.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Late last month, Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck said he believes President Obama has a problem.
I'm not saying that he doesn't like white people. I'm saying he has a problem. This guy is, I believe, a racist.
As a result of that comment, there's at least one organization working to create a problem for Beck. And that organization is colorofchange.org, which has been lobbying advertisers on Glenn Beck's program to pull their ads from his show. According to the group, as of Wednesday, they'd gotten more than 20 companies to do just that. Of course, those companies are mainly still advertising on Fox News Channel. They've just asked that their spots don't appear on Beck's show. But colorofchange.org executive director James Rucker is pretty happy with what his group has accomplished so far. James, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're talking about a guy who shows footage of Nazis while talking about President Obama. Why was this particular comment the straw that broke the camel's back?
This goes so far beyond the pale. I mean, when you call the president, whose mother is white, whose grandparents who raised him are white, and most of the people in his cabinet are white, the idea that he has a deep-seated hatred for white people, it's not just insulting, it's actually poisoning the public discourse.
So it's fear-mongering, it's hate speech, it's demagoguery, but it's also completely protected under the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Did you have to think twice about this?
I try to think twice about everything that we do. I would be the first person to stand up and protect Glenn Beck's right to free speech. He could be out on a corner somewhere, and he should be able to say what he wants to say. But no one has a right to a platform of cable news that reaches millions of homes. It's a part of private enterprise. It's funded by advertisers who make profits from consumers.
All right, fair enough. But I want to ask you to go back almost exactly 8 years to when Bill Maher, on his then ABC late night program, Politically Incorrect, said something, you know, pretty astonishingly stupid, that the 9/11 terrorists weren't cowardly. What was cowardly was lobbing cruise missiles into alleged terrorist camps in Afghanistan and I think it was Somalia, and wound up losing his sponsors and then his show. At the time, were you so sanguine about the right to exercise your economic influence on a TV network?
Right. So he expressed an opinion, which, you know, I think certainly would upset a lot of people. But it's, to me, clearly in the realm of opinion. And it's not a systemic attempt to divide American society and also, you know, endanger the president and repeat things that are known to be false in the context of a program that's supposedly news and information and political commentary based in fact. I would still actually say advertisers, the American public, can exercise their economic muscle, and they don't like what someone's saying, they can reduce their platform, absolutely. But I just think what's happening with Beck is very different, and I think it has very different consequences.
Okay, fine. But, ultimately, I can still say to you, the guy's a hater, but if I don't like the stupid stuff he's saying, I can always turn on CNN and watch Lou Dobbs and get a very thoughtful point of view.
And this is, I think, the core issue here. And this is not just Beck, but I think Beck really does represent the worst of the worst. You can turn off Beck, or I can turn off Beck. What that doesn't do is take him and take his rhetoric out of millions of other homes in this country. And if you look at, for instance, the town halls, you've got bands of very angry, very scared Americans, largely white, and they're getting a lot of that misinformation from a set of talking heads, and Beck is one of them. And this idea that what we're witnessing under Obama is America's undoing, this is reparations under the guise of helping folks who are unemployed or making sure people have health insurance, that this is really about them and not us. When you're a corporation like a Procter & Gamble or a Geico or, you know, these other companies that have pulled back, I think they recognize, it's, okay, what are we actually enabling here? Because it actually is bad for society.
Okay, one final question for you. If it's true, as Fox has asserted, that the advertisers haven't really pulled their ads but just moved them elsewhere on the Fox News Channel's schedule, have you really achieved anything?
I'm not in the advertising business, but, you know, common sense supply and demand tells me that when you have everyone leaving a show, the actual value of the ads on that show will likely go down. Secondly, I think, and this is actually important, if the only advertisers that Beck can attract are obscure, non-household names, it marginalizes the show.
Well, I hate to break your heart as much as the news broke mine, but Glenn Beck got the highest ratings of his career this week.
Oh, I'm very aware. There's a market for what he's doing.
All right, James, thank you very much.
Absolutely, thank you.
James Rucker is executive director of colorofchange.org. We contacted Fox News Channel to request an interview with Glenn Beck or a spokesperson who could talk about Color of Change's campaign. They informed us that Beck is on vacation and referred us to a statement they'd released in response to Beck's comments about President Obama. Quote, Glenn Beck expressed a personal opinion which represented his own views, not those of the Fox News Channel. And as with all commentators in the cable news arena, he is given the freedom to express his opinions. The big story out of Iraq this week was about a massive simultaneous bombing episode that struck Baghdad on Wednesday, killing nearly 100 people and injuring more than 500. The violence threatened to undo a feeling of relative calm in the city since U.S. forces pulled out in late June. But there are quieter attempts to turn back the clock in Iraq. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been working to impose new restrictions on the Iraqi media with a law that would, among other things, block websites deemed harmful to Islam, including sites that feature gambling, alcohol, or pornography. Last week, Iraqi journalists and press freedom advocates poured into Baghdad's book market to protest. Loosely translated as, "Our freedom is guaranteed. We don't want it imprisoned." NPR's Deborah Amos was at the protests. She explains that the issue for many people isn't necessarily whether this law passes the parliament, but rather what it says about the prime minister.
I think the reason that journalists, publishers, diplomats have been concerned about this is because it gives us some idea about the prime minister's thinking, that he does want more control over the media in this country. It's not altogether clear if he's going to get it. There's been a couple of measures that he's been able to take without passing any laws at all. One of them is he has been asking for internet cafes in this country to register. And that is feeling to some people like censorship.
You covered a protest a week ago in Baghdad of domestic reporters who were up in arms about the proposed changes in the media laws. Are they afraid that these provisions nominally attempting to safeguard public morality are some sort of Trojan horse for more extreme censorship in the future?
Yeah, and they wanted to go on the record, and they picked a very interesting place. Al-Mutanabi Street is famous in this country. It has been a cultural center for generations. It's lined with bookshops. And every Friday, there's always an open market. People with magazines, English language, music, political tracts, all out on the street for sale. So this has been a place of an exchange of ideas. Even under Saddam Hussein, you could go into one of these bookstores and find some illegal tract behind somebody's desk. So they went to Al-Mutanabi Street to make their protest.
At least in terms of the freedom of the press, Iraq has in some ways fulfilled the Bush vision of democracy. It's certainly a bigger free-for-all there than elsewhere in the Arab world, isn't it?
Mostly because there are no laws. In 2003, in the American invasion, this country was thrown open to all media. Everybody bought a satellite dish, and they were feasting on Lebanese videos, on Turkish soap operas, on pornography, and also sites that encouraged terrorism, that encouraged sectarian hatred. Everything came here because there was no apparatus to stop it and no laws to stop it. People were a little busy here over the last 5 years. Remember that there was a sectarian civil war, and the last thing on anybody's mind was to think about press censorship. Now that the country has become a little calmer, you are seeing politicians begin to think about exerting control.
I saw a quote, I think in the New York Times, by a deputy cultural minister named Taher Nasser Al-Khmud. The sentence is quite remarkable. It's, "Our Constitution respects freedom of thought and freedom of expression, but that should come with respect for society as a whole and for moral behavior." Those are kind of antithetical thoughts. Has anybody in Iraq noticed that they are mutually exclusive?
Look, there is a side of Iraqi politics that is of the Islamist flavor. And it is true that Iraq is out of line with its Islamist neighbors. There is certainly more censorship in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in Syria, in Jordan, for that matter, even in Lebanon. This is the Wild East in terms of what comes into this country. And there are politicians who don't like that. And there's a constituency on the ground for that. I have seen quotes from people saying, "Please take these things off the web. It's making me bad." This is not a society that is used to these kinds of freedoms.
Do you think we in the West are more concerned about all of these issues than anyone in Iraq? I mean, given the level of violence and political instability that they're facing?
I think it's a good question because the Iraqi media didn't take this up as much as the Western press did. But there is a small group of intellectuals and a small group of politicians in Iraq who use it as a gauge, who are mostly secular and want to secure Iraq in the secular camp. Because the danger here, of course, is if you become a more Islamic country, which Islam is it going to be? make it a more secular country, and you avoid some of those tough questions.
Deb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah Amos is a foreign correspondent for NPR. She joins us from Baghdad. By February of 2008, life had become unbearable for Matthew Allen Shepard. He was in over his head at work. He charged some personal items on his corporate credit card to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. He felt stressed and trapped by his mistakes. And so he did what many thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people do every year. He vanished. Specifically, he faked his own death, fled to Mexico, and assumed a new identity. But after 2 months, he got lonely and missed his family. So when, in anticipation of rejoining his wife and daughter, he asked for the girl's school records, he was caught and imprisoned for fraud. Shepard's story features prominently in the September issue of Wired magazine in a piece about what it takes to disappear in the digital age. Wired reporter Evan Ratliff and senior editor Nick Thompson wanted to know if all the technology we use and all the digital traces we leave behind make it easier or harder to disappear. In the course of working on the piece, Ratliff and Thompson had another idea. Why don't they see for themselves? Ratliff would vanish for 1 month. Thompson and anyone else who wanted to could try to find him. The reward? $5,000, $3,000 of which will come out of Ratliff's pocket. Wired senior editor Nick Thompson joins us to explain the rules. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Tell me specifically what Evan is permitted to do in hiding from the world.
What we've done is we've set up a whole series of rules to make sure it's not too easy for him to get away. What he has to do is he has to constantly be on Facebook, be on Twitter. He has to create new accounts, but he'll be on there somewhere. He's checking his email, apparently, and he's given me all of his passwords and all of the information that a private investigator would have. So I have his credit card statements. I have his bank statements. I have his fast track, the equivalent of his easy pass statements. I've got a lot and a lot of data on him, and I'm publishing it online. And Evan, of course, because he's computer savvy, is hiding his tracks. So, for example, I logged into Evan's email this morning, and it told me the last five places that anyone had logged into Evan's email from. So I have the addresses of the computers that he logged in on. So I published those on the website on Wired.com. Readers look in, they check the addresses, and it turns out, well, actually, it looks like he's been in Moscow, he's been in Boston, he's been in Germany, all within the space of a couple of hours. So,
because, as we've reported on this program, there is software out there that is very useful in China and Iran that enables you to get onto the internet using the IP addresses of remote computers so that the government can't track you down.
Right. So Evan is taking advantage of software used by dissidents to hide from me.
Now, one of the rules is that he can't really disappear. He can't go into the woods somewhere with a tent and a Coleman stove and just chill until the month is gone.
You know, it would be very easy to go into Yellowstone for a month and nobody would track you down. So we said, you know what? You have to stay in cities. You have to pretend to be living the life of somebody who really has tried to start anew. So he's going to be living like he would want to live in a normal world, and he's going to be doing things like trying to find a job that he would do if he were to disappear for his whole life, not if you just have a one-month experiment.
Has he screwed up so far, left too big a clue, failed to cover his tracks in a material way that has surprised you?
Well, I don't know. He's certainly given us some clues about things he's bought, and, you know, he's driving north according to tolls, but it could all be misdirection. Yesterday, I got quite scared. Somebody created a Twitter account under the name Thrimp Johnson. And Thrimp Johnson is a name that Evan sometimes uses online, and we mentioned that. And somebody immediately figured that out. And then they noticed that whoever was tweeting as Thrimp Johnson is at a golf course in Sacramento. So they said, go to Sacramento and get him. And for a second, looking at the Twitter feed, I thought, oh my God, Evan created far too obvious a false identity. Somebody's figured it out, and they're going to get him on the second day. This was way too easy. But of course, he wasn't there. Who knows who was there? Who knows who created that account? Who knows what Evan? Another fun clue. So yesterday, there's something on his credit card. It's a FedEx delivery. It's being delivered. Okay, let's put in the tracking number. Let's figure out where it goes. Oh, it's going to Washington. How interesting. Let's see who signed it. If we get that, we'll get a clue. Turns out the person who signed for it was named D. Person. Uh-huh. Monkeying with us again, so who knows?
In Evans' original story about Matthew Alan Shepard, he made reference to the movie Day of the Jackal from the 70s, about how easy it was for the international assassin to create a new identity for himself by simply finding a death certificate from a dead child and getting documents created. It's not so simple in 2009. And can you tell me the ways in which it is so much less simple than it used to be?
Well, okay, so let's say it was the 1970s and you want to start anew. You disappear and you begin again. People try to find you. Well, first of all, they're going to need photographs of you. Where are they going to get those? Well, they can call family members. They can track it down. But where can you get photographs of Evan Ratliff? They're all over the place. You can get photos from his ultimate Frisbee team in college. He has a Flickr stream. There are photographs of Evan absolutely everywhere. Okay, well, in the 1970s, you want to learn about somebody. You want to learn their habits. Well, it turns out that Evan has a Facebook page that you can mine, and you can learn everything about him. The guy likes soccer. He likes Frisbee. He likes to drink beer. Or actually, doesn't like to drink beer anymore because he's just been diagnosed with celiac disease, which we know about. So now we know he likes to drink cheap red wine. So suddenly, you can build a very good profile of who Evan Ratliff is based on the little pieces of information that already exist and that are searchable through Google.
And you know not to look for him anywhere gluten is served.
Right. I talked to a friend of his today, and I said, so where should somebody look for Evan Ratliff? He said, look for a guy in a bar, reading a book, drinking bad wine, and eating a burger without a bun, and you've got him.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me here.
Nick Thompson is a senior editor at Wired magazine. He is the chief investigator in the worldwide manhunt for Evan Ratliff, who, if he chooses to resurface, will be on our show to tell us all about his adventure. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. We all know how difficult a time newspapers are having trying to turn a profit. So difficult, in fact, that many new journalistic enterprises are abandoning the for-profit model altogether. In 2005, a venture capitalist put up the money to launch the Voice of San Diego, a nonprofit organization focused on local investigative reports. In 2007, MinPost.com, also a nonprofit, was founded to provide coverage of Minnesota. And then there's ProPublica, which set out in 2008 with the help of tens of millions of dollars in grant money to do local and national investigative reporting, sometimes teaming up with the likes of 60 Minutes, The New York Times, CNN, and even our producing station, WNYC. A slightly different model is coming from long-established nonprofit groups that are starting their very own news organizations, like the Kaiser Family Foundation. In 2007, it launched Kaiser Health News, its own news service devoted to healthcare issues, yielding articles that have been reprinted in the Washington Post and elsewhere. After a 20-year career as a newspaper reporter, Jim Barnett has made a beat out of covering all these nonprofit news organizations. It started 5 years ago when he was working in the D.C. Bureau of the Oregonian and felt like the Bureau's days might be numbered. So he left the newspaper and set out to learn all he could about the nonprofit world. And he blogs about it for the Neiman Media Lab. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You've written that in the nonprofit model that good journalism alone won't do the trick. What else do we need if not just good journalism?
The ones who are succeeding, who have been recognized, these are nonprofits that have developed a deeper relationship with their readers and have succeeded in converting readers into donors. They see it as a two-way conversation, and they like to host events for their readers. They interact with their readers, which is not something that comes naturally to newspapers. But beyond that, I really think that the ones that are going to succeed for the very long haul are going to have a smart business plan. Strategies include membership development, much like a lot of the local public radio stations, pursuit of corporate sponsorships, and also pursuit of advertising dollars as well. you know, perhaps even developing some for-profit subsidiaries that can help supplement revenue just like a for-profit would in a lot of ways.
Let's talk about interest groups being the benefactors of a news organization. You've written about the Kaiser Family Foundation, which they were worried about health and medical reporters taking buyouts and otherwise losing their jobs from major news organizations. They started hiring them themselves. By what means does the reporting get to the world?
Largely online. They have their website and an email service as well. What they have produced has been a lot of really solid data that are cited in news reports, as well as some analysis of some very difficult topics. One emblem of the fact that this is seen as equal to newspaper journalism is that a lot of their coverage is now picked up by newspapers, including the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Now, let's just say Kaiser in particular is pure, and it has no agenda that it is going to pursue at the expense of objectivity or truth or balance or what have you. And, you know, maybe we can say the same about Human Rights Watch, but maybe not, because after all, it is an advocacy organization. But I'm willing to bet that we couldn't expect an even-handed treatment from a labor union like the AFL-CIO if it decided to start funding journalism. Is this not a slippery slope?
It's a very good point, because I think a lot of advocacy organizations are looking around and saying, hey, wait a minute, why not us? And one criticism of the foundation model is that you create a whole new universe of sacred cows, that if you're focused on one particular area, you may be blind to other areas that need to be covered. And that's what a newspaper does very well by being broad in its coverage. And one of the things that I think that needs to be decided is, what does separate a news organization from an advocacy organization? How thick must that firewall be? This is something that journalists really should decide and should talk about right now going forward, because if we don't, the question will be decided for us. And I'm speaking here as a journalist.
One final thing. When you mentioned to your colleagues that you were leaving the Oregonian and were going to start looking into nonprofit journalism, I imagine you got some funny looks from friends who probably thought you were a little unhinged. I guess nobody thinks you're unhinged anymore.
They did sort of scratch their heads and say, you know, gosh, you know, Jim's a pretty dedicated journalist. Why is he getting out? But I think more importantly, what I have seen is the seismic shift within the population of journalists that I know. Even up till 2 years ago, people saw newspapers, serious reporters saw newspapers as their ultimate destination. Now, that's no longer the case. People recognize that there may be an answer here, not the answer, but an answer. And so I think that's what has been the sea change in the last year.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Jim Barnett is a former reporter for The Oregonian. He blogs now at Neiman Journalism Lab. Jeff Jarvis blogs at buzzmachine.com and teaches at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism, where a large study called New Business Models for News was just completed. CUNY hired business analysts to suppose a place that doesn't exist yet, but one many fear will exist all too soon. A U.S. city with a metropolitan population of 5 million and no daily newspaper. The business analysts took their best shot at predicting what would happen to the news marketplace in that hypothetical city, what new news organizations would spring up, and how many reporters could they hire? How much ad revenue would they bring in? And once they came up with the results, they posted all their spreadsheets on the web and encouraged people to tweak the numbers and to make the model more accurate. Jeff Jarvis, welcome back. Hello.
Hey there.
You set out to answer a simple question. Can journalism be sustained in top 25 metro markets if all of the city's dailies should fold? So I have a question for you. Can journalism be sustained in top 25 metro markets if the papers there all fold?
Isn't this the cue for your jingle, Bob?
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
The tough question we've been asked often is, well, what does happen to journalism if the paper dies? And we believe that it won't be replaced by a single new entity, but instead by an ecosystem of many different players operating under many different, you know, means, motives, and models. We found there are hyperlocal bloggers today who are pulling in $100,000 to $200,000 in revenue. That alone told us there is a sustainable business here for journalists, many of whom are leaving their newspaper jobs and are trying to do this. When you add it all up, we believe that there is a robust news ecosystem that can serve this community for less cost, but still profitable. A bunch of smaller players, each one profitable, each one sustainable.
We just got done speaking with Jim Barnett about the nonprofit part of the ecosystem, foundation money principally, that would fund the nuts and bolts journalism that we most depend on currently from existing newspapers. You've just mentioned hyperlocal bloggers. What other species are in the ecosystem?
So we looked at the hyperlocal blogger. We looked at a framework that enables networks to be created that really make this work so that people can sell ads across each other. We looked at the not-for-profit news like NPR that fits into this ecosystem. And we looked at what we call the new news organization, the successor to the newsroom now, made up of journalists who still do beat and investigative journalism. That is the backbone of all the news. However, they also have other new roles. They need to work collaboratively with this network of hyperlocal and interest bloggers. They maybe need to train them. They need to curate their work. It's a smaller organization. We project up to 46 people in the new news organization after 3 years. However, if you add up all the staff from all the blogs and the new news organization, we see a staff of about 275, which is equivalent to an existing newsroom for a city this size.
And do they make any money, like enough to pay the rent and buy groceries? Or are they subject to the forces of supply and demand that have already driven so many people out of work?
Of course, one should never believe a business plan, but ours shows that at the end of 3 years, these are businesses that bring in margins that are reminiscent of the glory days of newspapers. However, Bob, these are much smaller businesses. So a 30% margin on a $20 million business is not the same as a 30% margin on a $400 or $800 million business, which is where newspapers used to be. So it is smaller, but it is profitable, and that means it's sustainable. It's sustainable on advertising primarily, but on other revenue streams as well, running events, doing databases, all kinds of opportunities.
As you cobble together this ecosystem with, you know, sort of the spare parts of the old model and the internet, do your plans foresee recreating in entirety what we've had from the good old days in the New World Order? Or are we going to have to just do with less quality journalism?
No one is going to know what the promised land looks like till we get there. But as an optimist, I think there is a good opportunity that journalism can become better, richer, more deeply involved in the fabric of society, that we can cover more towns, that journalists can specialize and work in depth in their topic areas. Now, that's my rosy view. Is it possible that that won't work? Sure. In fact, we're bound to have some level of chaos in between. I had this dreamy vision that we were going to have this kind of January 21 in journalism where the print president would hand off to the digital president and off we go. Well, it's not going to be the case. If a paper dies, you're going to see chaos. You're going to see bad guys get away with stuff. But I believe, Bob, we're then going to see a market demand for journalism. And what we think out of our study at CUNY is that the market can meet that demand. And at the end, I have the faith and the hope that society will demand quality journalism and that there's great new ways to bring that to people at a more efficient cost, in more depth and detail, and that we can actually improve journalism, not just save it.
You debuted your findings in front of a bunch of big thinkers and big mockers at the Aspen Institute this week. What kind of response did you get there?
It was gratifying to hear these mockers adopt our language of new news organizations and hyperlocal networks and frameworks and networks. So what I really saw was that they were acknowledging that huge change is upon us. There are those who wish they could just protect the old paper the way it was, and they're still around. But the mockers even recognize that change must come. Now, we can then debate exactly how that happens, and that was the debate at Aspen. Next, in New York, we hope to take this to the entrepreneurs who are going to build this future. But I think that there is an acknowledgement in all quarters now that journalism is changing, must be rethought and reinvented for a new age.
All right, Jeff. Well, I certainly hope your optimism is well-founded. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Jeff Jarvis blogs at BuzzMachine.com, teaches at City University of New York, and is author of the fabulous book, What would Google do? Don Hewitt died last week. The CBS News veteran of six decades was the creator and for 36 years executive producer of the seminal TV news magazine 60 Minutes. In that span, 60 Minutes won 73 Emmys, 13 DuPont Columbia Awards, and 9 Peabody Awards. It did so because Hewitt understood that important journalism could be dramatized by potent storytelling without contaminating it with cheap populism, cheap sensationalism, and cheap tricks. 8 years ago, marking the publication of Hewitt's memoir, he spoke to Brooke about 60 Minutes and his mastery of the form.
Mr. Hewitt, after you've exposed hundreds of cases of government malfeasance, dozens if not hundreds of cases of falsely accused convicts, hundreds of cases of illegal and unethical business practices, why does anyone sit down for a 60 Minutes interview anymore?
Morley Safer and I were once in Philadelphia speaking at some meeting, and one of the questions from the audience was your question. Why does a guy who is obviously a crook decide to go on 60 Minutes? And Morley said, because a crook doesn't believe he's made it as a crook until he's been on 60 Minutes.
Right at the beginning of your book, you lay out your political positions on everything from race relations to same-sex marriage to gun control to God, not to mention your entire voting record over the last 3 decades.
Right,
now,
right.
I applaud that, and I think it's really interesting because your colleague Dan Rather recently got into some hot water by appearing accidentally, he said, at a Democratic fundraiser. Now, one ethicist we spoke to about that situation says it hurts press credibility to reveal your political stripes. I take it you don't agree.
No. I'm an open book. Why shouldn't I be as open as the people we go after? Look, I have finally decided that there are two words that I would like to see expunged from the lexicon. It's liberal and conservative. I have no idea what they mean.
You've said that behind every magazine show is a failed sitcom.
With one exception.
Mm-hmm.
Because we started it.
That's
but
right.
The rest of them came along and they... If those sitcoms hadn't died, there wouldn't have been those magazines.
And you've also said that there isn't enough news for the number of news magazines. Don, you're the father of the genre. Shouldn't you be more nurturing?
I would if they were using them as news magazines and not as filler.
Summarize what you think is the problem with a lot of the news magazines that followed 60 Minutes.
Well, it's the same thing that's wrong with most television. They're in a game. It's called Sweeps Week Roulette. My favorite Sweeps Week was the week that WCBS actually did Dangerous Dry Cleaners. I'm telling you, Saturday Night Live couldn't have dreamed up anything funnier than that. And it's all nonsense. And the problem really is, you can't really compare us to newspapers. Newspaper publishers are in the newspaper business. Broadcast companies are in the entertainment business, and news is a very small part of what they think about, what they care about. And if a broadcast comes along like 60 Minutes and it makes some money like it's going out of style, well, then they pay attention to you and you become somebody around there. If you don't, you're filler. When I started 60 Minutes, I worked for a marvelous man named Bill Leonard, who said to me, "Make us proud." I don't think anybody in television has said to anyone else in television in the last 30, 40 years, make us proud.
Have you made any concession to demographics to try and get a younger audience?
No. No, I don't know what the demographics are. I've never seen a demographic breakdown. I've never seen one of those minute-by-minute Nielsen things that tells you where it peaks and where it goes up and down. I don't want to look at it. The trick in this business is to recognize that there is a line that separates news biz from show biz. And the trick is to walk up to that line and touch it with your toe, but don't cross it. If you don't go anywhere near it, you lose your audience. If you walk over it, you lose your soul. So you want to find out, where is that line? And how do you know where that line is? I don't know how I know where that line is. I just kind of know it.
You, Mike Wallace, Morley Safer, Andy Rooney, are all in your late 70s and beyond, after you all retire, will the legitimate news magazine go with you?
Remains to be seen. Chairman...
I can't believe you said it remains to be seen. You should be ashamed of yourself.
You happen to be right. You absolutely happen to be right.
Are you like Supreme Court justices? You have to keep working because who knows who they'll appoint after you're gone?
There may be some of that, but mostly it's to feed yourself. I don't want to die in a rowboat. I don't want to die in a canoe.
Don Hewitt, executive producer of 60 Minutes and author of Tell Me a Story, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Don Hewitt died Wednesday on dry land at his home near the Long Island Sound. He was 86 years old. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Glotke, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back one of these days. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.